Okay, I'll call to order the Senate General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection Committee. Colleagues, today is Monday, February 3rd, 2014, and we are convened for the purposes of organizing the committee, and then we will have an informational meeting on Senate Bill 1521. Jana, why don't you tell us where we should go?
Certainly. Chair Shields, well, first we'll talk about the rules. The 2014 session rules are largely the same as the 2013 session rules, except with shortened timelines. We're under 24-hour notice for any meeting, public hearing, or work session. Informationals are under one-hour notice, and we may move to one-hour notice when sine die is imminent. Another change is, in order to consider an amendment by this committee, it has to be available on OLIS 1 hour prior. It must be available to OLIS 1 hour prior to working the amendment. So if you want to propose an amendment for that particular work session, it needs to get to me sooner rather than later. And on minority reports, you must notify me of the intent to file a minority report by the adjournment of the meeting.
All right. Thank you, Jana. Any questions for Jana?
I just thought she was going to tell us where to go, but I'm glad she did.
I'll tell
first
you where
to go.
Senator George.
Chair Shields, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 3rd, 2014.
Senator George moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 3rd, 2014. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Burschiger.
Yes.
Senator Moniz Anderson.
Aye.
Senator Brzozinski.
Aye.
Vice Chair George.
Aye.
Chair Shields.
Chair votes aye. The motion passes and the rules are adopted. I will close the organizational meeting and open an informational meeting on Senate Bill 1521. Chana.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1521 is one of your committee bills. We had a very similar bill to this one in committee in 2012. It prohibits the practice of commercial interior design or the use of the title registered interior designer unless the person is registered with the Board of Commercial Interior Design, which this bill establishes. It also establishes qualifications for registration as an interior, a registered interior designer.
All right. Thank you, Jana. What we will do, we have invited testimony only since this is an informational meeting, not a formal public hearing. So we will hear from the proponents, and we'd appreciate it if the proponents could keep the overall testimony to about 25 minutes. And it looks like we have 7 people lined up to testify on the proponent side. The opponents will also have 25 minutes, although always concision is appreciated if at all possible. Don't feel like you have to take the entire time. And then we have three, perhaps four people signed up as on the opponent panel. So that being said, could we please bring up Ingrid Hoffman, Denise Durrell, Alicia Snyder-Carlson, and Ellen Cusack. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. How do I work this?
Just one side.
You got it. Get myself over here. Good morning, Senators. Thank you very much for having us here today. My name is Ingrid Hoffman. I'm here on behalf of IDC Oregon to support Bill SB 1521. I am an interior designer. I am certified by the National Council of Interior Design Qualification, which is the NCIDQ, and I am certified as a lead AP by the U.S. Green Building Council. I am currently employed as a senior interior designer with LRS Architects in Portland. Better? And before that, I was a sole proprietor of an interior design company for more than 10 years. IDC Oregon is a nonprofit organization founded with the goal of enacting licensure for commercial interior designers. We believe that legislation supporting the registration of commercial interior designers serves to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public and ensures the ability of trained professionals to practice to the fullest extent of their capabilities. IDC Oregon is a collaborative of current and future design professionals and industry allies, including many members of two of the most recognized design organizations, ASID and IIDA. Our supporters include many of our professional organizations, again, IIDA and ASID. Excuse me. Our industry vendors, design educators, architecture and design firms, and the green building industry. Here's a couple of top reasons to support licensing for commercial interior designers. Number one, consumer protection. Commercial interior designers are responsible for the interior environments in which the public spends most of their time. It is therefore in their hands whether these spaces are safe and healthy for the occupants. It's good for business. Many interior designers operate as small businesses, and registration would allow them to practice as registered professionals in the state, which would provide access to a scope of work that is currently restricted, and it also provides credentials for professional recognition by potential clients. Number three, sustainable future. An interior designer's body of knowledge regarding safe and healthy building systems, components, and finishes also encompasses environmental sustainability of these same systems and materials. So starting with health, safety, and welfare. A commercial interior designer's scope of work. So you can see from this diagram that the interior designer's scope of work in public buildings is quite extensive. These spaces, in order to be safe for public occupancy, must be designed to meet state building codes, fire and life safety requirements, energy codes, ADA accessibility standards, as well as environmental considerations such as air quality, ergonomics, non-toxic materials, user functions and comfort. If you're curious about more detail of this, if you follow this link that's at the bottom of the slide, it's an interactive map that will show you every area of a building and what considerations have to go into designing each and every space, and give you a really good sense of what exactly a commercial interior designer does. Of the $75 billion in products and services specified in interior design projects in 2008, 82% of that was specified by interior designers. And yet, they are the only professionals on a construction design build team that are not allowed or required to be licensed or registered. From the Oregon, moving on to businesses, from the Oregon Bureau of Labor Statistics, there are over 530 Oregon jobs in the interior design industry, 141 businesses, and $157 million in the industry for state revenue. Section 107.1 of the 2010 OSSC, the Building Code, states that the construction documents for interior for design projects must be prepared by a registered design professional. As of right now, that does not include commercial interior designers. We can do the work. We cannot stamp the drawings. There are over 318 designers in the state that could be registered professionals today, that already have the qualifications, have passed the exams, and could be registered professionals. Could add to that 141 businesses, could be 318 more small businesses operating on equal footing with other registered design professionals. On a personal note, I moved my business here from California in 2008, where I was a registered designer. My first job here was a space over 4,000 square feet in Portland. So the portion of my fees that would have been profit was paid to an architect to stamp the work that I had performed. Interior design is a flourishing profession. The blue and purple indicates states with the largest number of interior designers. As you can see, Oregon is in the second tier behind California, Texas, New York, Pennsylvania. If you look at this next slide, those same states that are mostly blue also happen to be the states where they have already enacted laws allowing certification, registration, licensure of the interior design profession. What will licensure for commercial interior designers do? It will establish standards of practice for the interior design industry. It will help consumers know that they are working with qualified professionals. It will allow Oregon designers to bid on government projects, which they are currently prohibited from doing. It will encourage sustainable and green practices, and it will reduce toxic interiors and sick buildings. What it will not do, it will not limit, restrict, or prevent the practice of interior design. We are not trying to stop anyone from doing their jobs. It will not limit or restrict or prevent anyone from using the title interior design or interior designer. It will not cost the state money, and it will not create an all-powerful board. The bill is specifically targeted for commercial interior designers. There are exemptions for single-family dwellings, for retail sales, for decorators, for townhomes and condos, and for all other licensed professionals in our industry. It also is exempts designers who are working already under a licensed professional. SB 1521 allows the title of Oregon Registered Commercial Interior Designer so that we meet the code requirements for registered design professionals to be able to not only do our jobs, but stamp and submit our drawings for permits. It requires the same components required by other similar fields: education, degree from an accredited design program, experience, relevant work experience under qualified design professionals, and passage of the NCIDQ exam. Do we want to take any questions now, or should we go through all the rest of our testimony?
Why don't we go through the panel? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, and committee members for letting me speak with you today. I am Denise Durrell, and I'm an interior designer in Portland, Oregon. I currently work for Design Techs. I graduated in 1990 from the University of Oregon with a bachelor's degree in interior architecture. I worked for 14 years as an interior designer at an architecture practice. I then chose a path to represent a company that helps designers daily with material use and practice in their practice. I know firsthand how important it is to work with qualified interior designers. Interior designers are the key to ensuring safety and well-being that occupy, for all people to occupy their buildings. I currently hold the office as president of the International Interior Design Association of Oregon. IIDA has more than 13,000 members in specialty forums and 33 chapters around the world to commit and enhance the quality of life through excellence in interior design. Over the years, IIDA has worked tirelessly to enact interior design registration laws across the country, with IIDA members playing significant roles in passing interior design laws. To date, helping to protect people living in 27 states, including the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and 8 Canadian provinces. As a part of IIDA, the IIDA Oregon chapter works to advance the value of interior design and its practitioners, as well to cultivate leadership in the profession. Comprised of over 250 members and growing, IIDA Oregon is an active voice in the community and enjoys a full calendar of diverse set programs throughout the year to promote and enhance the profession of interior design, including monthly educational seminars, tours of award-winning projects, design competitions, community service projects, and invaluable student day. IIDA Oregon recognizes the importance and supports the adoption of legislation individuals to be registered as interior designers. These laws assist the profession in establishing and maintaining standards and safeguards for the health, safety, and well-being of the general public, defining responsibility and encouraging excellence in the interior design industry. Our chapter works diligently to educate our members about the importance of legal recognition for interior designers. IIDA Oregon strongly encourages and supports the efforts of Interior Design Collaborative of Oregon to establish licensure for registered interior designers in the state of Oregon. Thank you, Chairman Shields, Vice Chair George, and the committee members for letting me talk to you today.
Thank you for your testimony.
Hello, Chairman Shields and members of the committee. Thank you for providing me the opportunity to testify today. On behalf of IDC Oregon as well as the American Society of Interior Designers Oregon chapter, I am here to provide testimony in support of SB 1521. My name is Alicia Snyder-Carlson. I live in Southwest Portland and am employed as a green building consultant in one of the top consulting firms in the nation. I'm also here as a board member of IDC Oregon and ASID Oregon, as mentioned, the Oregon chapter of the national organization. I also serve as chair of the National Legislative Advisory Council, which helps legislation throughout the country. I have a bachelor's degree from the University of Oregon and a Master of Fine Arts degree in interior design with a focus on sustainability. I'm a LEED accredited professional and an active member of both IIDA and ASID. I personally chose to become an interior designer because I have asthma. I struggled with poor indoor air quality throughout my life, and I believe that interior design can change lives, and I entered the field to help design for at-risk populations. This desire led to an understanding of how interior design can affect and change lives. When you consider designing for autism, veterans with PTSD, and the elderly, we take into account factors that not all building professionals understand and create spaces that support health and healing through evidence-based design, but we also meet life, safety, and fire codes. With a renewed focus on sustainable design in Oregon and across the country, a greater demand for qualified commercial interior designers will continue to grow. We've already started to see some of this need in Oregon, with Oregon State facilities in Bend having to make costly upgrades to meet ADA and other code issues. We believe it's time for Oregon to set the stage for the next generation of commercial interior designers. Additionally, the state and federal mandates on material ingredients and restrictions are becoming more stringent as studies relating to human health and interior materials are published. Commercial interior designers are trained to understand material regulations and requirements that keep occupants both safe and healthy. Finally, on behalf of the ASID Oregon chapter, we urge you to pass this bill in order to expand recognition of the profession, unbind the currently restricted scope of work, allow all qualified professionals to be part of the full design bid selection process, safeguard consumers, protect our students' future, increase the state's revenue, and assist small business owners to grow. Oregon would join the 28 other states across the country that currently have interior design laws. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Shields and committee members, for the opportunity to testify regarding the importance of this legislation to Oregonians. My name is Ellen Cusick, and I've been practicing interior design for 15 years here in Oregon, and have been an educator for 12. My practice is focused on both residential and commercial interiors, and I teach at Portland Community College as well as the Art Institute of Portland. I'm also a graduate of the Art Institute, and I'm an NCIDQ certificate holder and a member of IIDA Oregon and a board member of IIDC Oregon. According to the NCIDQ website, the interior design process follows a systematic and coordinated methodology, including research, analysis, and integration of knowledge into the creative process to satisfy the needs and the resources of the client. As educators, we provide the means for students to execute careful research and analysis on lifelike design problems and to use their findings to solve those problems creatively while adhering to local building codes and ADA requirements. Our students are thoroughly educated in building systems, how the building works, from framing and construction to mechanical and electrical systems. They're educated in building codes, local, state, and federal, including life safety, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and energy codes, and the designer's responsibility to clients, the environment, and the end user. At each of the colleges in the state, the students pay tuition, many of them relying on student loans. And it's vital for these students to be able to use their degrees in their chosen fields to repay those loans and to make a living in Oregon. The current square footage limitation outlined in Section 107.1 of the Oregon Structural Specialty Code can be a significant factor in any designer's ability to make a living and therefore hire a new graduate. The more opportunities the state creates for current commercial interior designers, the more support the state provides for these new graduates. By regulating commercial interior design, we're giving those students, once qualified under the terms outlined in the bill, more opportunities to bid on and win commercial design projects. By doing so, we We create a stronger local economy and encourage recent graduates to stay and work in the state. As an educator, I strongly encourage you to consider this bill for the future of commercial interior design students, as well as the health, safety, and welfare of Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Senator George.
I think we've had this conversation several sessions in a row, so let me kind of give you my perspective and see if you can, the four of you can respond. What we've seen in the Capitol is a creation of boards to govern, and they're always brought by industry people who ask for a board or a regulatory body to be set up for the protection of consumers, and what they turn into is protection for sort of the insiders of that industry, and it's the economic term is called rent seeking, but basically they create a cabal at the commission level to, in essence, eliminate competition. That's a lot of our concern, right? Because we don't want to be anti-market. If you were bringing forward to me a bill that said, well, we want to broaden our scope of practice, and I think your point was well taken, that there's a statutory code that says you have to be a registered agent. If you were bringing to me saying, look, we just want a way that if we pass the NCIDQ exam, DCBS recognizes us then as registered. If we pass that exam and then we're registered, and you just want to broaden your scope of practice, I'd be very, very supportive. When you want to put together a board where there would be regulatory and enforcement provisions that would, in essence, make it more difficult for people to compete with you, then that basically puts me in a position where I'm trying to decide, pick winners and losers, and I don't want to do that. So I guess here's the question. Is there a different way about going about this bill that would make it so that you could broaden your scope of practice without creating a regulatory agency that can, in essence, block people from competing with you? That was a long discussion, but I wanted you to understand where I was coming from.
Do you want to take that, or do you want me to?
You can.
Well, first, we are interested in exploring the idea of doing a shared board with a board that is potentially already established for one of a similar industry, construction industry. So our interest is not in creating a board that is going to protect our interest. It truly is in allowing people to do these jobs and become registered design professionals. My understanding of it is that we will need some sort of regulatory body to create this thing, whether that's a shared board so that we're not creating, as you said, another board to another cabal. We would be interested in exploring that option as well.
I think your suggestion as well to look into other paths to broaden the scope of work is definitely something that we need to look into.
Yes, Senator George, and then Senator Przanski.
I guess my point is that you already have this organization, and I don't exactly understand how your industry works, but you guys take an NCIDQ exam, which is some kind of national standardized exam, correct?
Like the architectural exam.
Exactly. So you guys take that, and what you're concerned about, if I understood you correctly, is that you guys would like to be able to stamp your own work and not have Big Brother Architect review it, right?
Correct.
And that, to me, that seems to be the whole entire problem here. So it seems like to me if we empowered DCBS to simply acknowledge that accreditation, and that's all they did, that's all it took to be a registered interior designer, right? You could have interior designers who didn't take the exam, and they could still do whatever they wanted, and people could hire them. Or you could have people who took the exam and DCBS signed off that they were a registered one, and you wouldn't need any regulatory. You wouldn't need any kind of regulatory structure other than did you pass the industry exam that qualifies you to stamp the work. Do you have any objection to that?
No.
Okay, that's all I want.
We appreciate the comment.
What is DCBS? I'm sorry.
Department of Consumer Business Affairs.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Well, you've got 1 month to get this amendment done.
Yeah.
Not even that.
Yeah, exactly. A week.
So, I mean, that's what I wanted to follow up on, what Senator George said. It seems to me you really got two things that you're working on. The first and most important one, and I forget your name.
Adrian.
Was that you did all this work, and then you had to go and get an architect to basically just stamp your work.
Correct.
And so it seems to me that that's the primary issue is if you are qualified, meet the standards, you should be able to sign off on your own work, and then the consumer will be able to hire you directly to do the work, and or if they needed to go with the architect, you could have one that is either registered, certified, or one that works in-house.
Yes.
Thank you.
I think that the questions were very interesting, and I think you bringing this forward got us thinking about other potential solutions.
Absolutely.
And
that's
to
great.
See if there might be some compromise there.
Yes.
So thank you very much for bringing this forward. We'll move on to the next part of the panel. Kyle Holzkamp, Carla Green, and Roberta Pennington. Welcome to the committee. Who would like to go first?
I will go first. My name is Kyle Holzkamp. I am a IIDA member, former vice president of the OSU chapter of IIDA, and also worked in a small commercial interior design firm in Corvallis for a year and a half. So I've seen some of these issues firsthand. As a recent graduate, I'm educated in developing construction documents to not only design a space, but to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public. I'm committed to my industry, but currently slightly frustrated with some of the regulations. And per building code, as we've gone over, construction documents have to be stamped by a registered design professional. And due to this regulation, many designers are required to hire an architect, as we've established. It's creating an unnecessary step which stalls the process and I think hampers projects. Wasteful steps threaten the creation of the commercial interior design jobs, and many of my classmates have lost hope and moved on to other states where opportunities are more prevalent and available. In my opinion, licensing would help create Oregon jobs by allowing us to stamp our own work and provide opportunities for talented local graduates and fortify the economy. Thank you.
Well done.
Good morning. My name is Carla Green. Thank you for letting me speak to you this morning. I am an Allied ASID member. I'm the owner of Green Design and Remodeling, LLC, and I hold a contractor's license, 197199. I'm a residential interior designer, and so you might ask, why would I be here to support this? At about age 50, I decided to go back to school. I went then to Merrillhurst and obtained a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Interior Design. But my aha moment came when I thought about what is required of designers, meeting the education, experience, and examination requirements, and it sets an expectation and a standard for clients and the public. Most people know what an architect does, a landscape architect does, what an engineer does. But very few understand what exactly an interior design does, whether it's commercial or residential, and does get confused with interior decorating, to be sure. And maybe that's why interior designers are the only members of the construction trade that are not licensed, which I found unusual when I took my contractor's licensing exam. You've heard the phrase health, welfare, and safety of the public, and what does that mean? Well, to me, it means the design of a space, how a space will be used by its occupants, to make sure that the occupants are not compromised and that they can use the space for what they need. All of that, of course, is hidden in the final project, which hopefully is perceived as successful and beautiful as well as safe. So my age, general life experiences, and specific knowledge have led me here today. I'm a voting member of the community, and I appreciate this legislation. I know that there are national groups that will argue against this legislation, and I would ask you to take a look at what their message might say and why exactly they are opposing this. I believe in the integrity of the entire interior design profession, and feel that it can only become stronger with this legislation, stronger for the profession, stronger for the public, stronger for you and me. Thank you.
Good testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, good morning. My name is Roberta Pennington. I am an NCIDQ certified commercial interior designer. I'm an associate interior designer at Ingram Moisson Architects in Portland, Oregon, and I have over 13 years of professional experience in the state of Oregon. My original degree was in theater, so I'll try not to jazz hands you to death. My second degree is in interior design, and I chose interior design. And first and foremost, and I'm going totally off script now, sorry, and it happens all the time. These guys will attest. But I went into interior design initially because I was out of a job because of said theater degree. And I watched a lot of cable television, and the first was this show with Christopher Lowell, who was fabulous. And he talked about the seven layers of design. And I ended up going to the interior design program at Kent State in Ohio, thinking I was going to be fabulous too. And as I sat down in my very first design studio, they said, yes, you can pretend everything's going to be fabulous, but for the next 4 years, you will see a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. And literally, there was blood. I mean, X-Acto knives and everything. But what I found is that it's more about a professional integrity in the programs, and it's about the health, safety, and welfare. It's about code interpretation. It was space planning. It was what's appropriate for our end users. And that's what inspired me to move forward with an interior design, a commercial interior design degree. I think I enjoyed the level of professionalism more than anything. So now I'll get back onto script and bore you to tears. This isn't my usual speaking style in script, so bear with me. thanks, guys. So my testimony today will focus on the arguments provided by one opposition voice. That's the National Kitchen and Bath Association, and how their arguments are not necessarily relevant to SB 1521. So the following are arguments from one of NKBA's robo-letters. I'm sure you've seen a few of those pass your desk with the same comments. So this bill will not license the entire design profession, as Ingrid pointed out. It will exclude the following professions: registered architects, registered engineers, licensed contractors, those working under the supervision of a registered interior designer or a person described in SB 1521, those practicing interior design for a single family residential dwelling or farm building. I have to add in all the good wordy words. An auxiliary structure to single family residential dwelling, so like a mother-in-law suite, or a farm building, or a single residential unit in a multi-family residential dwelling, so that's like an apartment or a townhouse. And then finally, those providing decorative services or assistance in the selection of surface materials, window treatments, wall coverings, paint, floor coverings, surface-mounted fixtures, or loose furnishings not subject to regulations under building or fire codes. I'm sorry, I'm shaking. I'm like excited like a wiener dog. So SB 1521 is not anti-competitive. In competition, and for a consumer to best understand the value he or she is getting, comparing services on an apples-to-apples comparison is most beneficial. In many cases, qualified interior designers are closed out of the RFP or request for proposal process for many government contracts because no legal definition for registered interior designers is in place for Oregon. SB 1521 increases the field of qualified design professionals and increases the opportunity for consumers to secure their best value. SB 1521 is not anti-business. All interior design and architecture firms within the state of Oregon fall into the definition of small business. As such, these firms will see increased benefit by adding value to the services offered. As stated previously, many businesses fall under exemptions and will see little to no impact in their business operation. My personal experience, I've been a sole proprietor, I've worked in small businesses, I've worked in large businesses. So I see what the impact of this bill will have. For the sole proprietor, it gives them the ability to stamp their own drawings and permit their drawings and give their clients additional value. And a large firm, it adds value to the product that we're bringing to the table. So it's a more complete design group under one roof. And finally, SB 1521 is not anti-consumer. Even with credentialing from private sector design professional associations like IIDA and ASID, clients and sadly employers still do not see the added value of these initials after a name. Qualified interior designers still need to educate their constituency and often need to prove their worth before ever sitting at the table. By having this bill in place, a qualified interior designer will be able to point the consumer to state law and show the state has made an effort to protect them.
the NKBA in one of their robo-emails also said, in today's difficult economic climate, the state government should undertake no act which would make it more difficult for its citizens to compete in the free and open market unless there is a clear and convincing evidence that the public is being harmed by the failure to regulate. And I think this statement is better read as, of course, I'm going to revise it, as the economic climate continues to change and commercial properties are seeing an increased demand for improvements, the need for understanding who is qualified to make these improvements is imperative. This understanding will include who is qualified to make these improvements and who is providing the best interest of the end user. As my colleagues provided earlier, evidence does exist for the need to regulate the practice of commercial interior design. All professions started as professions without governmental oversight. Over time, though, practitioners and consumers discovered a need to regulate as the definition and scope of work changed and the scope of services offered narrowed. A great example is the field of real estate. Regulation is in place for the express definition for commercial versus residential brokerage, as these two fields are vastly different and require a different skill set to practice. The same is true for interior design. As our practice has developed over time, skill sets have narrowed and current laws have become restrictive for qualified commercial interior designers to practice. SB 1521 will alleviate this restriction. NKBA refers to our group as a small group of interior designers, but our small group of interior designers supporting SB 1521 includes all of ASID, which is 28,000 people, IIDA, 1,200, 13,000 respectively, and we also include in our ranks many registered architects, registered engineers, clients, family members, and friends who understand the definition of qualified commercial interior design. And contractors. Senate Bill 1521, okay, this is an NKBA, again, for their big mass email they sent out recently. Senate Bill 1521 would create a new license of registered interior designer requiring a four-year undergraduate or master's degree in interior design and passage of the private, expensive NCIDQ exam, along with mandatory continuing education and state licensing fees. And I say yes, all these statements are true. If you look at the source of the statement, the NKBA, though, the same can be said of their organization. So they require a certified education, so the schools that where they provide NKBA certification have to go through a process in order to qualify. They also have a qualifying exam, $300 plus $100 annual renewal. I think that's pretty expensive. They also require 10 hours of continuing education hours, which is what SB 1521 is asking for. And then they also have annual fees to join the organization. It's similar to the other accrediting or professional, private professional organizations like IIDA and ASID. So really, therefore, NKBA supports a qualifying outline for a professional definition of what an interior designer is. I want to thank the members and the executive board of the Interior Design Collaborative Oregon for giving me the opportunity to speak before you today. And I thank you also for your time this morning. And we open up for questions.
Just help clarify, for residential you don't have to have an interior designer, but for commercial you do. I need to know, I've had remodeling done, but I know an interior designer was not a part of the process. Was there, or is there supposed to be?
Well, some of the benefits, and maybe I need to know a little bit more about your experience.
With residential.
With residential. Mm-hmm. So when you went forth with your design process, I mean, was there was a need within your home, and so you went to a store, or you flipped through magazines, or
I went to a local business, and they came in, and then I chose what countertops. I was basically just... I just added a washer-dryer to a room, but basically kept everything as is.
Mm-hmm. So with residential, the codes are pretty loosey-goosey. I mean, it's not as strict because you aren't dealing with the public. You're dealing with a single, usually single-family dwellings. And as we outlined before, the type of services that wouldn't fall under. A lot of the work can be cosmetic. You'll bring in licensed contractors to do a lot of the utility work, plumbing, electrical. If there's something structural, then you would be talking with a licensed architect or licensed engineer.
Necessarily an interior designer.
But an interior designer would ask you the questions of...
the finishes that are appropriate to your kitchen, what's appropriate as far as how you live as a person in your own home. I personally don't do residential, and maybe that you'd be a much better person to ask about
that. Well, it's not
that.
Maybe pertinent to the bill.
But what commercial does, to kind of look at the other side of the coin, what commercial does, it's more about the public safety and welfare. So I, as a space planner, because I do all commercial and I do all office planning, would look for appropriate exiting, what the building type is, where the public right-of-way is, so when there is an emergency in a building, you can exit the building safely and quickly.
Senator George.
I keep coming back to this, so I'm going to ask this panel the same thing. There's a big difference between a registered, as the statutes or the Section 107 says, a registered design professional,
mm-hmm.
a registered versus a licensed. And I think the concern we have, a lot of us, is that once you get into the licensure, and you mentioned the real estate, and since I'm not running for re-election, I can say it, I agree with you, the real estate community is one that's built up a whole series of regulations to block people from coming into their industry. So it's a perfect example. So if you wanted to create a registration process where you say, we pass this test and therefore we're registered, and you can access the work, I think I'm fine with it. If you want to create a licensure where you can then basically create a whole series of 10 hours of continuing education and all these things before you can enter into our industry, I'm going to be very resistant to it, because every single field I've seen in this building that has a licensure creates barriers to entry. I think you're facing those right now, if I can just say this. Most of these industry groups, they do it under consumer protection, but what they really are is their industry protection. And that's the concern. And so what I want to get back to is there is a difference between registered design professional and licensure. And that's where I think you may find a lot more sympathy. You know.
Could I just say something? As a licensed contractor, I would say that
I'm Carla Green. The licensing procedure for becoming a contractor does weed out those people who do not care to get the education, acquire the knowledge, to be able to do the work, the required work. And I know we all have horror stories or have heard horror stories about contractors who have ruined structures or not done the right work. So I would say that in that case, the licensing requirement is of value to the public. I would also just say that the NCIDQ examination is much more rigorous than the CCB licensing exam, having taken that. I have not taken the NCIDQ, but I have seen the exam. So that we are relying on education and examination in the contracting field, and just letting anyone do anything in the design field, which I think needs to be more brought into balance. And whether it's registration or licensing, I think you brought up a very valid point, and thank you for it. We'll take that under consideration.
Yeah, and I think we've kind of laid out where most of the committee members are on this, and we appreciate you coming to testify. Let's move on so that we can give a chance for the opponents to have their fair amount of time as well. Thank you. Could we please bring up Patty Morrow, Dan Curtis, Curtis Wilson, and I think there might have been one other person who was interested in testifying. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Patty Morrow. I'm the president of Interior Design Protection Consulting. We have offices in California, South Carolina, and New Hampshire. I personally live in South Carolina. So what's a South Carolina girl doing in Oregon? Well, because of the short time that was allowed, these five national trade associations have asked me to come here to speak to you on behalf of their Oregon members. This is about jobs. If you enact this bill, this bill will have a restraint of trade effect on the whole design community, stifle competition, it'll create a monopoly, and it will artificially inflate prices. Take a look at this list. These are the prohibited services that would not allow the interior designers of this state to continue to practice these services. Now, these are people who have been practicing interior design in this state for many years. You heard the number 530, and that it's actually higher than that. I believe that that number does not include self-employed, but it also does not include other members of the design community who may not consider themselves or title themselves as an interior designer, but who work providing interior design services like kitchen and bath designers, commercial food service, lighting designers, and many, many others who actually practice these services. You heard a challenge that you should ask us why we oppose this bill, so I'm going to tell you why we oppose it. Basically, four reasons. And I'm going to take about a minute to explain each of these reasons to you: the need, the benefits, the public, and the cost. You heard an awful lot of testimony today about protecting the health, safety, and welfare of the public. But members of the committee, there is not a shred of evidence to warrant a conclusion that the unregulated practice of interior design harms the public in any way. In fact, 13 state and government agencies have done extensive research and all submitted reports on this, and without exception, every single one concluded that interior design regulation would add absolutely nothing to protect the public beyond the measures that are already in place. Only four states have ever enacted interior design practice laws. Now, you did see a map and you heard testimony showing 20-something states that have similar regulation. That's not true. Only actually three states right now that have practice acts that prohibit people from practicing. And those were all enacted over 20 years ago. Now, there was another one, too, Alabama. But in 2008, that law was struck down and declared unconstitutional. Where's the public outcry? There is no public outcry. The public is not confused about interior design services. This bill has come about exclusively through the efforts of industry insiders and not as a measure of public demand or legislative determinations that interior design regulation is needed for the public benefit. So who does benefit? We've heard about the NCIDQ exam. Well, the NCIDQ exam has on their website this function called the Q search. The Q search is where a consumer can go to find an NCIDQ certified interior designer in their state. This is the list of NCIDQ certified interior designers in the state of Oregon on this Q search, 38 in the entire state. Now, the proponents will say, well, it's voluntary. Not everybody is on that. But all these people who went through the process of getting certified and they don't even want to have their, you know, their credentials publicized, it doesn't make sense at all. Now, you also heard testimony that 318 people would qualify right now if this law was passed. But what that person did not tell you was, and this is where they got that, this is right from the NCIDQ website, that's a screenshot. What they did not tell you is that 318 number, that is the number of people who have passed the NCIDQ exam since 1974. It does not take into account designers who have moved from the state, designers who are no longer practicing, designers who have retired, designers who are deceased, and designers who do not support licensing. So how many designers are there really? The truth is nobody really knows, but we do know this. It's a very, very tiny number. Now look at all the organizations who are opposed to this law, this bill, if it were to become law. There are so many groups, and this is as many as I could fit on the screen. Last told, I think there were 28 organizations, national organizations, that opposed. Then you have the local organizations. You have the fire chiefs. You have the building officials. You have the retail associations, which includes Lowe's and Home Depot. There's an avalanche of opposition to this anti-competitive law. Who would bear the cost of this? Well, certainly the consumer. The National Trade Administration did do two studies on this, concluded that interior design regulations would result in higher costs and fewer choices to the consumer. The state would certainly bear a cost as well. The cost of creating and maintaining a state board. And if so many fewer people are allowed to design, it would take their tax dollars right out of the state treasury. Interior designers would also bear the cost. The NCIDQ exam is burdensome. It can cost up to $2,000 to take when you take into consideration the cost of the exam, the cost of study materials, the cost to travel to take this two-day exam. And the NCIDQ exam has historically had a less than 40% first-time passage rate for all three sections taken at the same time. So many people have to go back and pay the extra cost to take it again and again and again. SB 51 is bad for business, and it's bad for Oregon. Please protect the honest, hardworking citizens of this state and reject this effort that's come through by some industry insiders that are asking you to shut down their competition. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Shields. My name is Daniel Curtis. I'm president and chief owner of Curtis Restaurant Equipment, a 50-year-old company. We're headquartered in Springfield. We have offices in Bend, Medford, and Beaverton. I strongly oppose Senate Bill 1521 because it would prohibit our company from engaging in the design of commercial food service kitchens, which has been a key element of our company's business since our founding in 1963. Please reject Senate Bill 1521. This is about jobs. Our company employs over 50 people in the state of Oregon, with our offices in Medford, Bend, and Beaverton, as well as Springfield. We design, equip, and install food service facilities throughout the state. These projects range from small, independent, and chain restaurants, churches, K-12 schools, colleges and universities, hospitals, and wherever else food service is served in a commercial application. As an example, we are currently providing the food service equipment for the new state hospital in Junction City. In 2012, we were recognized by the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association as their vendor of the year. Our design staff has combined over 40 years of experience in our industry. They follow all state, local, and federal codes that pertain to commercial food service design. Our commercial kitchen design work is much more than a floor plan. It includes information pertaining to the plumbing, electrical, and mechanical requirements for all the equipment in the kitchen. This information is used by the appropriate trades to properly connect and service the food service equipment. Our staff provides this service quickly, efficiently, and economically. Mr. Soon Lee, who's here today, works for us. He arrived here from Vietnam in 1981 at the age of 17. He's worked for our company since 1989, almost 25 years. Soon is considered one of the finest food service equipment kitchen designers in the Northwest. If this legislation passed, he would not be able to perform his job. If passed, this legislation would increase costs to the operator and greatly increase the time necessary to gain permits and approvals. The legislature should only consider licensing when the health, safety, and welfare to the public is in jeopardy. There is absolutely no evidence of harm to the public absent this licensing. Senate Bill 1521 is anti-small business at a time when we need every job we can get. Unemployment is high. We can hardly afford to lose more jobs. The great majority of the work our company does is initiated through our design department. We alone would have to cut many of our 50 jobs. I urge you to protect our rights to earn a living and reject the efforts of a few industry insiders who are asking for an unnecessary monopoly of commercial interior design. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kurt Wilson from Eugene, and I'm a principal at Pivot Architecture. Of our 32 employees, five are interior graduates, four of which are from the University of Oregon's Interior Architecture Program. My comments here today are not about a lack of respect or lack of value to their contributions to our office and to design in general. More specifically, I'm here as a legislative chairman for AI Oregon, American Institute of Architects. I'm also here to represent the national organization. AIA's policy related to title regulation in the built environment is that only architects and engineers licensed through examination possess the necessary education, training, and experience to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public in the built environment. Other individuals may possess useful skills in designing within the built environment, but fragmentation of responsible control of the building design process endangers and misleads the public as to the respective areas of competence and expertise. The AIA opposes practice or title regulation of individuals or groups other than architects or engineers for the design of buildings. I also want to address some of the comments that have been made regarding building permit application and submittals. Our building code, the Oregon Structural Specialty Code, is essentially the international building code, which is developed by a national organization adopted in most states. Oregon has adopted it with some modifications, mostly where there are amendments that are laws that apply to the building code. The issue, the references that have been stated previously are from the international building code and in the administrative procedures. They address, the term that's used in the international building code is registered design professional. More specifically, though, the Oregon revised statutes that cover the application of the building code, the laws about the building code, specifically include an architect or an engineer as professionals who can submit building permit applications. And the director of the Building Codes Division has stated to us, that's his interpretation, and in his opinion, I'm stating what he's told us, that this law will not have any effect on that requirement. The law is the law as it pertains to who can submit for building permit applications. Also,
Can I ask you a question? What part of the ORS were you?
One statute, and there's multiple. One statute is ORS 455.645. That's specifically about public assembly, but it's a reference in other sections as well.
Thank you.
I also want to address both the building code and the laws that pertain to the practice of architecture and engineering, which are two separate statutes, address what only an architect and or an engineer can do. They include, and some of this is covered also in the building code requirements, they identify exempt buildings. Exempt buildings are basically, and it can be an existing building or modification to a building, where that modified area, the overall building area, is less than 4,000 square feet, or some of the other statutes that areas you saw, such as single-family residences, farm buildings, and whatnot. You do not need to be an architect or an engineer to submit to do that kind of work, and that's done all the time. Residential falls into that, small commercial as well. But very specifically, for the reasons of a rigorous process of the defending of the health, safety, and welfare of our community, architects are required to do projects above that. However, the way that this has been discussed today, it's as if either an architect does it or an interior designer works on a project. We live in a collaborative world. Every project that we're involved in has a design team that includes architects, engineers, and others, and in our case, interior designers who are internal, but we've also hired interior designers as consultants. We're all working and we're all contributing to the success of a project. The issue of a practice is specific to the protection of the health, safety, and welfare. And as I stated before, AI believes that architects and engineers are the ones in our profession who are qualified to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the individuals. Thank you.
Senator Przanski.
Yeah, thank you. So this is a question for each of you. Mr. Wilson, I probably know your answer, but I'd like to hear it anyway. What we've heard through the presentation from the proponents is that they would be happy if they could just be registered and be able to sign off on their own work where it doesn't have to go through an architect for that approval. Is there something that you know within their training that would not qualify them based on this national standard, that they would not be able to do that work and sign off on their own without having an architect?
Projects over 4,000 square feet, which are not exempt from the requirements, require an architect because of the rigorous requirements we have for education, examination, and training. And so I think it's not a matter of whether, it's really a matter of the high level of rigor that we have in our process that really puts architects in the right position for the state to restrict what we do and look after the health, safety, and welfare of the community. For instance, the Bachelor of Architecture degree is a 5-year degree. The Bachelor of Interior Architecture at Oregon is a 4-year degree. There's similarities throughout the length and the duration of the examination process as well. I don't know enough about let me say this differently. We have a very developed training program called the Intern Development Program that's implemented by all states in the country. It's a 3-year project. 3-year plus, it's a very rigorous process. I don't know the standards nationally for training, similar training programs for interior designers, but I think that is the one distinction as well. It's just the rigor of our process.
Let me ask if you could please provide to the committee any examples in other states where they are licensed and registered to be able to sign off on their own work where there's been problems. That's one thing I'd like to know. Mr. Curtis, if I could ask you, based on what you heard earlier, if someone was able to actually have their work signed off on by themselves, you could still have your employees doing the work that they're doing today. Would you have a problem with this bill?
I don't think so, if it was in combination with that. But in looking at it, when we work in collaboration with architects on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. They hire us to do kitchen designs. We're in our Medford office. I was there Friday, and our manager there said he's working with 3 different architectural firms right now that have hired us to do projects. The young lady back here works for Angrim Moisson. We do projects for that company. We're doing a big project for them right now. They hired us. They don't have the staff and their ability to do that work. So we're a little bit different in what we do. We're pretty specialized.
I understand.
So I'm
familiar with
you. I'm not sure that I can comment.
What I heard from your comments, Mr. Curtis, was that you're concerned that what you have now currently was going to be jeopardized and you would not be able to maintain those individuals working for you. So if this bill was changed and it actually just said these individuals who meet the qualifications can actually be certified to sign off on their own work, you'd still be able to have your internal work that you do now. And it seems to me that you yourself would not have a problem because you can continue your status quo.
That's probably correct. I have to see the bill, of course.
Yeah. We all would.
Yeah.
One other question, if I could. I'm sorry, ma'am, your name?
Patty Morrow.
Ms. Morrow, I was taken back by how your presentation was, so I'm curious, have you given this testimony to other legislators or other states?
Absolutely. I've participated in killing 150 bills like this in the last 7 years.
So now that you've pretty well, I mean, it seems to me you're out there protecting your groups and your industry as to what you perceive as a problem. Based on what we've heard from the proponents, they'd be more than willing to have a bill go forward that just would allow them to sign off on their own work if they meet the qualifications. Where would you and your corporate interest stand on a presentation of a bill like that?
I think it would depend on what's in the bill and what you mean by qualifications.
You got the NCIDQ, which apparently is the regulatory system right now. Is there an issue with that?
Okay, the NCIDQ is not a regulatory system. It's just a private exam. I would not be in favor of that because I'm not in favor of giving a government-sanctioned marketing advantage to these few people who have passed the exam when it's not been proven that there's any health, safety, and welfare that can be gained, that the public is gaining anything. If it's just a matter of recognition, I'm all in favor of that, but allow it for all interior designers. Until interior designers do not kill people. So I would be in favor of allowing that for all interior designers that did not have anything to do with structural, of course, or health, safety, and welfare.
Mr. Chair, if I could just also make the same request from her.
Sure.
If you could provide us with any examples, since you've traveled the states and given this presentation, killing 150 different bills, where this has actually been a problem, because I agree with Senator George. It does seem like we are having turf wars in the sense of you perceive this is going to somehow jeopardize, and I understand how the bill's currently written, it could. But if we actually said, if these individuals meet a standard, that they should be able to sign off on their own work, and it seems like right now, from what I understand, there are certain sizes of work that can be done without needing to be signed off by an architect, then it just seems to me, are we somehow limiting the ability for these professionals to do their work, and are we limiting a consumer from being able to go to that individual to do that particular work where they may not need the expertise of an architect?
Absolutely. I will send you some statistics and facts on that. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you could please send it to the committee administrator.
Okay.
For distribution to the committee. Senator George.
Mr. Wilson, I guess here's where, as this panel started, I really started to agree with your panel as we were on this end, and then as we got to you, it went different because I felt like you guys were arguing opposite sides. So let me explain to you why I think that, and correct me if I can. If you have an environment where we're opening up things that do not threaten safety, things like that, does not threaten the consumer, we open it up for more people to practice that, which is what we want to do. Then what you do is you'd create if we want to keep this in the code where we say you have to have a registered design professional, you'd create a bond and then you registered with the state and you could practice as long as your customers were willing to do that. And I felt like that was kind of the direction you were going. As I got to where you were, it seems like what the architects want to do is basically say this is our scope of practice, this is our scope of work, and we want to keep people from coming in and competing with us. And I guess here's where I am is I don't want to create another licensure. I don't want to create another whole regulatory scheme to allow interior designers. At the same time, I don't see the threat to the public, there's not been a compelling case by either proponents or opponents that there should be a structure where people who are doing interior design are a danger to the public, including from the architect's perspective. So from my perspective, the burden is on everybody who wants to have this as a regulated enterprise, whether it's the architects or whether it's the interior designers. I don't understand why everybody wants to have this regulated, because I don't see the threat to the public on the interior design side of it. Where is the damage to the public if somebody who's really creative decides to go into interior design in commercial buildings, as long as a person is willing to hire them to do it? And so I guess here's where I am. From your perspective of the architects, if these folks could register with the state and sign off on their own paperwork and somebody was willing to hire them, what's the damage to the public for that?
There's nothing that stops them from doing that now. There's exempt. The practice of architecture...
You're talking about over the 4,000 square
feet. Well, that's the practice of architecture, and that's limited to the issues pertaining to health, safety, and welfare.
Would you oppose us removing that requirement so they could practice above 4,000 square feet?
Yes. That infringes on the practice of architecture, which is defined in another statute.
Right, but we could change that statute.
I understand that. So, yes, we do have concerns about that.
Why is that?
Because the standard that an architect goes through is very high.
I get you there. I agree
with
you. You guys do a lot of work, but why can't I practice
it? The standards in this document to be an interior designer are not very rigorous, and most of the people who have spoken here today in defense of it, of the act, probably meet the standards that are in the document, but there are a lot of people who aren't. For instance, there's a clause in here that allows for the next 4 or 5 years people who haven't met those standards to become interior designers through simply a grandfathering clause.
Real quickly, Mr. Wilson, I think we're talking past each other. Why is this regulated so that only architects can do it?
It's simply just an issue of the level of standard that the public is willing, and through the legislation, the public is willing to have for issues pertaining to health, safety, and welfare. The idea of exiting of a building is obviously very important, and that 4,000 square, that space could be anywhere in a building, could be on the 15th floor, and those issues pertaining to that particular space and how the building code applies to exiting and interrelates with all all the other parts of the building code is very critical. So having groups of people who are limited to just portions of the building code's understanding is, again, just a fragmentation of the health, safety, and welfare protection. So for me, it's really just an issue of the standards of health, safety, welfare. And I don't believe that there's nothing that stops an interior designer from doing work of the sizes that are exempt buildings and calling themselves that in place now.
But if we increase the exempt building size, you would object.
Then you're just exposing a broader portion. If you do that, Senator, then you're also going to be opening it up to people other than interior designers. There's two separate laws you could affect here. But we believe that the exempt building size of 4,000 square feet is big enough, and we do not in any way support expanding that.
May I offer one suggestion?
We'll take one more comment, and then I think since this is just an informational, we'll move on.
Senator George, I might offer you a suggestion. You might want to look at what California does. California has a private certification in place. They do not have a state board. They do not take any state funds. But they have certified interior designers who are allowed to stamp plans and submit them for the building process.
I guess, Ms. Morrow, and for everybody in the audience, nobody has made a compelling case to me on either side of what the public interest is. I understand architects versus interior designers and how you all are fighting over scope of practice, but that's not my issue. I just want, if somebody wants to engage somebody in a contract to do interior design, I don't see why I have to have sign off by an architect or anybody else to do so, because nobody's convinced me that there is a public danger to somebody practicing interior design. Mm-hmm. And that's my thing is that I think the fact that these folks are not able to sign off on plans when somebody's willing to hire them to do it, and the person who's actually getting them to sign off on it is the one who's going to be held responsible, why they have to go to an architect. And on the other hand, I can't figure out why there doesn't seem to be any public risk to it, and that's my frustration, I think, with the issue.
We'll call that a rhetorical question.
Thank you.
We really appreciate you all coming. Again, this is just an informational meeting. If this committee did decide to try to take some action, we'd have a public hearing and then a work session, so there'll be certainly plenty of chances to still weigh in on this topic. But we really do appreciate you coming. I think it's a topic that is fascinating. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. With no other business to discuss, our next meeting is
Wednesday
at 3 o'clock. So I will close the informational meeting, and we are adjourned.
All right.